The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Swing State Michigan by more than 40 percentage points as he shifts his sight to Super Tuesday and beyond.
I just want to thank everybody. You've been so incredible. The numbers are far greater than we even anticipated. The date, November 5 and January 20th, when we take over, cannot come fast enough because we're going to make America great again, greater than ever before.
The results deepening doubts about the future of Nikki Haley's campaign, but she is doubling down on her commitment to stay in the race.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, we are in the season. Good afternoon. I'm Drew Mariani. Thanks for being with me. Thanks to Fox News for that comprehensive breakdown of what happened last night. I don't know what you make of the former president's victory in Michigan. Will it continue? That's a big question. Super Tuesday right around the corner. President Biden, of course, he won as well. So I don't know. I can't believe we're talking about generals already. Michigan, if you didn't know, it wasn't a whole lot of coverage on it, right? Michigan held his primaries yesterday. And look, these things are almost foregone conclusions, right? It was expected that both President Joe Biden and the former president, that Donald Trump, they were going to win massively in their respective parties. I mean, people are invested in those candidates, period. Biden took 81% of the vote. Trump took 68%. Of course, Haley is on the ballot there as well. But there are some other interesting numbers to look at. The only Democrats running against President Biden are Marianne Williams, right? And Dean Phillips, who each took about 3%. But there were, this is what's weird, right? There was an additional 13 to 14% who voted uncommitted. And you're familiar with that, right? These were more than likely Arab Americans who were upset with President Biden's support of Israel. They were told to, you know, vote and send a message to the president. Let me fill you in on what happened. I don't know if you're aware. Let me start with this. Let's start with the Arab American community there who is not committing to President Biden. I saw some man on the street interviews where they're saying, hey, I can't vote for him. They are not happy with the way he has treated, you know, where they were upset with Biden's support for Israel after the October 7th Hamas attack, which was horrific, of course. So we'll see what happens there. They're making their voice heard in this audio. It comes from USA Today. I don't know what you think, but check this out.
I want to remind everyone that a vote uncommitted was a humanitarian vote. It was our vote to save as many lives as possible.
We have led a movement that is far exceeding expectations, using the ballot box to urge America to stop killing our families. That's all we're asking for. Just stop killing our families. It's actually not that complicated. Just stop killing our families, President Biden. You can do it.
This is a warning sign. It's a threat to Biden and his administration as a result of his decisions to put funding Israel's war in Gaza over our own democracy. And this voting bloc within Michigan, let me stamp that we are uncommitted to you, President Biden, and your reelection efforts.
Yeah, I mean, people are passionate. You could hear that there. I was just talking to Maggie before the show. I had lunch with somebody the other day, and we were talking about this guy who, he was a protester who was disenchanted with the way that the president, again, is throwing money in front of supporting Israel over Palestinians. Hamas is a terrorist group, right? I don't think anybody wants to see them. This whole phenomenon of self-immolation, that's when somebody sets themselves on fire, is just so bizarre. Maggie, you saw that story? Yeah, what I saw happen, as you get your headsets on, the people were praising him for this action. I mean, the man literally took his own life. I understand he's doing it for a cause. There's been hunger strikes, but to set yourself on fire, he was standing up, flaming. One of our colleagues here said it's almost like a reverse martyrdom. Instead of dying for a cause, you know, totally, for a good, just, beautiful reason, you're taking your own life. A little bit different.
Yeah.
What did you make of that? Did you see the video footage or familiar with it? What happened?
I did not see video footage. I just saw a very striking photograph of himself sort of half engulfed in flames.
I just don't understand the phenomenon.
I don't either. We have a lot of people that are willing willing to go to great lengths for the things that they believe in, and yet I feel like they're misguided in, yeah, in the steps that they take.
Yeah. Well, you know, this war, we'll see what happens. There's supposed to be going to be coming a break, I hope, in the not too distant future with some more relief. And I'm pretty sure Israel, their goal is just to eradicate Hamas. And I get it. I do. I totally get that. Hezbollah in the north over in Lebanon, there's issues there. We need to pray for peace in the Middle East, period. We need to pray for our leaders, too. Our leaders, that they make good, just, informed decision. This primary election, you've got Trump, who was competing against Haley, right? She took, by the way, 26% of that vote. I had Ed Morrissey on before. Ed Morrissey pointed out over at hotair.com that even though Trump had a smaller percentage than Biden, Trump still had 161,000 more votes than President Biden. And it's, some are asking, is this a portent in a very critical state, right, as to what is to come? Fox News went to the streets. They asked people if they were committed to a particular candidate. Janelle King, who's a political analyst, told them that there's more in play than meets the eye when it comes to the general election. Listen to Janelle King, political analyst.
I certainly wasn't surprised when I saw the outcome. I think we all know that President Trump has a commanding lead. So that's gonna usher us into pretty much being the nominee, right? I think we all know that. However, there's something interesting about this Nikki Haley situation that I think we're missing. I believe personally that the new swing voter is not independent. It's going to be everyone who decided that they want to support a candidate outside of Biden and Trump. So when you think about it, a lot of these people, a lot of these voters are not in play when it comes to polling. A lot of them will not answer the phone calls that says, if you had to choose Biden or Trump today, who would you choose? They're hanging up. So these voters are not in play. You know, with Biden, he obviously has to overcome a lot, right? He has the economy, he has the whole situation happening with Israel and Gaza and Hamas. So all of that. However, on Trump's side, it's mostly rhetoric. So I think he's in a better position to be able to win over new people. Who he selects as his VP pick is going to matter a lot, because that's going to send an indicator to these voters that you hear us. You know, I'm interested to find out whether or not he has a strategy from being able to loop in all of them. But I think it comes down to rhetoric. I think you should let the primary play out. Let Nikki Haley play out this primary. What the results are will be the result.
Well, she's going to stay in as long as she has money. So we will see her, and she's vowed to do so. So we'll see how it all plays out. It's interesting. It'll be over soon, though. They say by March 12th, this will be behind us, and you and I will be talking about, you know, some different things. Hey, NATO, I've been following this story there. Major change for NATO. Hungary's parliament voted to allow Sweden to become part of the military alliance. This is right on Vladimir Putin's front door, right? The Nordic country, it shares a border with Russia. And, you know, its neighbors, Norway and Finland, do, but it does have the Baltic Sea as its eastern border, and that's easily accessible to Russia. CNBC will tell you more about really what is a historic move, Sweden joining NATO. Check this out.
This is a massive announcement for NATO, because let's not forget, this is exactly what President Putin did not want. Sweden is poised to become the 32nd member of the Defense Alliance. Stockholm had applied alongside with Finland to become a member of NATO back in May 2022, so shortly after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine had begun. Having said that, Finland managed to join NATO last year in April, but Sweden had to wait almost 2 years. A NATO official confirmed to me that if all the paperwork goes through, we could see that official membership starting on Friday at a ceremony in Brussels. The key question here is, why has it taken so long for Sweden to get the final hurdle through that approval from Hungary? Let's not forget, it was not just Hungary. There were two holdouts, Turkey and Hungary. Turkey, essentially, they wanted to see more action from Sweden when it came to the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which Ankara has said that has raised concerns about terrorism. And then there was also concerns, well, actually, I should say that Turkey wanted to see the approval of sales of F-16s also from the United States.
So there are still some formalities to work out, but Sweden will now make the 32nd nation to become a NATO member. I wonder if Vladimir Putin has reservations about having gone in on February 24th, 2 years ago, thinking, hey, it'd be easy, just like I took Crimea, I'll roll in, I'll take over Kyiv. Or if he knew how much of his military would be destroyed, what it would cost, the sanctions that would be put on him, how things would ultimately play out with new members joining NATO. I don't know. Again, I go back to what I just said before, and it's on my heart to pray so much for world peace. I do think it's such a really critical moment. Now, I don't want to live in fear, and I don't want you to be afraid either. I think our prayers make a difference. I think they do change things. And just ask God to convert hearts, to protect nations, to, you know, I want to grow old, right? Don't you want to grow old with your children? Maybe even your children's children, and let them have a good life. I want peace to reign. It's a simple prayer, and I think God honors prayers like that. So every day in your prayers, and I'm just putting this on, there's two things I've been praying a lot more for. The souls in purgatory, right, because I often forget about them. Really pray for them. They can't pray for themselves. And then pray for the world. Pray for peace. Not just your own personal needs. We all have them. But let's pray for peace to reign and for those leaders. And if we've got a big election coming up, we'll certainly pray that God gives us good and just leaders. I saw a weird story. Let me leave you with this one here, too. This is a weird... Look, the economy stinks, right? Do you agree or you don't? Maybe you don't. I don't know. Maybe you think it's great. They say we're paying 30% more for food today than we were, you know, in 1970 or 80 or whatever the date was. I mean, in decades. It's crazy how high inflation has been. People say, oh, it's coming down. Well, it's not where it was 3 years ago. And the next time you go to Wendy's, you might want to make sure, you know, there aren't a whole lot of people around. And you're saying, what? Why? Well, this is a weird story. I told you, Wendy's has decided to start what's called dynamic pricing. And they're going to start using AI to figure out inventory levels and demands. And they're investing millions into new screens. Fox 2 in Detroit explain this to you. Check this story out.
The fast food chain will begin testing out new digital menus and dynamic pricing. So the dynamic pricing is when companies adjust the price of items throughout the day. So let's just say you want to go in for a Baconator for lunch. Well, it might cost you more around lunchtime because there's a higher demand than if you went later in the evening. And on top of that, Wendy's will also implement different offers according to the time of day. Wendy's is reportedly doing this and spending $20 million for all these changes, which are set to roll out at some point early next year. This is so interesting. First of all, Wendy's being first to implement this whole dynamic pricing. But second, what happens now? I mean, are you going to roll in and assume you're going to pay $6 for a burger, which will end up costing you $8 or $9?
Yeah. And I wonder what's going to happen with the 4 for $4 meal, you know, the four items for $4.
Yeah.
What's going to happen with that? Is that going to have dynamic pricing as well?
Could be. I mean, and if they're saying things like this will basically change throughout the time of day, even on offers, 4 for $4 is an offer. So it has to change there. And I also see that they've rolled out an AI enabled menu. So that means you're going to have a suggestion on what you order. So you might roll in that drive-thru and think, I want the Baconator, let's say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it might change your mind and sway you towards something else on the menu.
Well, we'll see how it works out. I don't know how you feel about it. I heard one person say, you know what? When you go to a fast food restaurant, you want to know, you know, what you're getting. I want the Baconator or the Big Mac or whatever it is. And I want to know what it costs, right? I don't want to go in there and see that it's $1.50 more or yeah, nobody's going to complain about it going down. But you know, Wendy's defense, you know, they do say that this dynamic pricing can allow Wendy's to be competitive and flexible with pricing. And it might motivate buyers to visit them, you know, and come at an off time where they can get a great value. Maybe they can test out a number of features that they think will enhance the customer experience. I don't like it personally. There's a lot of other industries to do it. Maggie, you were just talking about... was it Uber and Lyft that do this as well?
Yeah, I know that the cab driving services do that. It makes me think of like when you go to a nice restaurant and they have maybe like the market fish, and it just says market price.
Yeah.
And you never know what that is.
That's true.
But I mean, a Baconator is quite the same as getting like a Chilean sea bass.
You know, we didn't have this 3 years ago, and I don't think companies who are really worried about how much money that they are hemorrhaging right now. Food costs are crazy, as I said. They're coming up with creative ideas to build their bottom line. I heard a CEO from some cereal company the other day say that, you know, maybe you want to start having cereal for dinner. It's a cost-effective option.
Did you, Cyrus and I were talking about this the other day, Red Lobster. Oh, because Liz made those great cheesy biscuits the other day. Right. And we were talking about Red Lobster and their cheesy biscuits. And he used to serve at Red Lobster when he was...
Cyrus did?
Yeah, he did when he was young. They had this promo going the last like month or two of all-you-can-eat shrimp. And I think they highly underestimated the American public because they lost like $10 million or something on this.
Yeah, they had to raise the price. I don't know, was it shrimp? Was it lobster? Or was one of their products,
shrimp.
Right? And they raised it from 19 to 25 to whatever, and they still were getting, they lost millions.
Tons.
Tens of millions of dollars on it. So is it a reflection of the economy? I don't know. You know, dynamic pricing, it's used in a lot of different industries, hospitals and travel and entertainment and retail and public transport, as Maggie pointed out, and a number of others. But again, here's what might be coming your way. If the demand is high and the inventory is low, you know, they're going to raise prices on the spot. And it's the other way around. If all the other, if there's not a lot of people there, your prices will go down. So we'll see. It's just a strange story, right? It really is. Really strange story. Anyway, enough on the Baconator. Putting that AI is going to play. I told you, it's going to change the world as we know it. And that's a big factor in this thing too, right? Big, big factor. Hey, I want to talk about Alabama for a minute. And I'm a little concerned about what I'm seeing developing right now. Ever since the Supreme Court in Alabama, they issued a decision that some couples can go ahead and they can sue fertility clinics for negligence because, you know, remember the story I shared with you, I think it was last week, about a wandering patient knocked over some frozen embryos. They were on a cart. They got destroyed and they ended up suing. Well, now there's all this hand wringing that's going on. And it's not just in Alabama. The University of Alabama at Birmingham Hospital suspended its in vitro fertilization program because of that ruling. Democrats have proclaimed that it's a result of the Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade, and they're laying the blame at the feet of Republicans for allowing it to happen. Republicans, on the other hand, on both the national and state levels, including Donald Trump, have been very quick to say, we will protect IVF, and the state legislature is now scrambling to get laws passed that would do just that. Check this out as well. Here's a little more audio for you to help you better understand what's going on. It's unfortunate that you got a pro-life president like Trump and Nikki Haley defending the use of IVF. This comes from CBS News.
Republican primary frontrunner, former President Donald Trump, said he strongly supports the availability of IVF.
Today I'm calling on the Alabama legislature to find an immediate solution to preserve the availability of IVF in Alabama.
How should Republicans talk about IVF treatments?
What I will say is, don't have a knee-jerk reaction over this. We want to make sure embryos are protected. This decision needs to be decided between the parents and the physicians, no one else. Government doesn't need to start intruding into this.
The debate over Alabama's decision is now putting 2024 battleground Republican candidates in political crosshairs, causing the campaign arm of the Senate to encourage Republican Senate candidates to clearly and concisely reject efforts by the government to restrict IVF.
I think this will be a big political issue come the general elections as well. Life, you know, both sides are very passionate about it, but I really think the left is going to use this as a hammer. Ed Whalen joins me right now. He's a distinguished senior fellow of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He holds the EPPC's Antonin Scalia Chair in Constitutional Studies, which is appropriate since he served as a clerk for the late Justice. You want to read him? You can find him. You can find his confirmation tales on Substack. And Ed, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for your patience today, too.
Thank you, Drew.
So all this hand-wringing that's going on, you'd think that in vitro fertilization was about to be outlawed completely in our country, right? What do you make of the reaction to what we have seen coming out of Alabama, and what do you think is going to unfold in the days ahead as a result of this? How will it be used politically, and what do you think is going to be presented?
Well, so much of the response seems to be from people who haven't read the actual opinion or understood what it involves, which isn't to say that there aren't concerns that some people would have. Look, we as Catholics need to recognize that the position that that I embrace on IVF is not a majority position, and that IVF is overwhelmingly popular. Now, what the court ruled, as you correctly stated, is that parents whose IVF embryos were negligently destroyed had a claim for wrongful death for that destruction. Basically, it said that the term "child" in the Alabama statute, just as it had been construed previously to cover in utero children, also covered in vitro children. It's a pretty straightforward statutory analysis. I think there are some folks who are very upset because they see this as this liability as damaging to IVF clinics that supposedly can't operate if they face this liability. Interesting question whether or not that's so. It's strange to see so many people race to accept the position of the clinics on this. I think a lot of other people object to the fact that the court spelled out quite clearly that the life of a human being begins at conception. That is a biological reality. It's one that lots of people try to hide from. It's one that can make people uncomfortable. And obviously it's one that abortion supporters particularly like to obscure. Yeah. Even though it's clear that there's nothing in Roe versus Wade that depended on saying that life began at some later point. The viability line was not a statement about when life of a human being begins. It was the court's arbitrary judgment as to when that life might be able to be protected. So lots of confusion going on here, and a lot of it, I think, is politically motivated. Certainly the claim that this is a result of Dobbs, which makes no logical sense at all, is an effort to hammer Republicans and hammer the Supreme Court.
Yeah, no, I could not agree with you more. The Chief Justice, what's your take on this, who wrote a concurring opinion in what he stated, that every human being is created in the image of God, and each one is worthy of legal protection, including the unborn. The fact that he invoked God, that's prompted all this talk about Christian nationalism from the left. Your thoughts on that? I mean, a lot of people think that's justified. I think that's kind of crazy, but your thought on this whole dialogue about Christian nationalism, because he claims that these were, worthy of protection and creating the image of God.
Well, it's not Christian nationalism to believe that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these is the right to life. That, of course, is from the Declaration of Independence. It's our national creed. And what the Chief Justice was doing in his concurring opinion, speaking for himself only, was explaining what he took to be the original public meaning of the constitutional provision that gave special emphasis to the sanctity of life. He was explaining what that meant. He wasn't saying that he had some sort of free-ranging authority to impose his views of the sanctity of life. He was looking to the legal text and explaining what that meant.
I only have a minute or two left. Your thoughts in terms of the implications. Will the decision have any implications beyond Alabama's borders?
Well, I guess who knows is a big question. I mean, the Alabama legislature is looking to alter the law, which whatever one thinks of this as a matter of policy is the way things ought to work in a democratic republic. That is, the legislature enacts a law, the court interprets it as best it can according to its public meaning. If the legislature doesn't like that, it amends the law. Yeah. So that seems to be happening. The biggest problem that I think people can agree with on IVF is its creation of excess embryos that are then you know, sort of recklessly destroyed. And there are European countries that have very tight limits on this, but somehow, you know, it's a Wild West in this country. So that may be an area where one could get some consensus, but it sure seems that, you know, lots of folks think that any regulation at all here is not justified.
Yeah, it's a good area to start. Hey, Ed, thank you for your time. I know Confirmation Tales can be found on Substacks, and I'll put a plug in for it. It does make for great reading if you want to get the inside scoop on how our current justices were able to be confirmed or not. You might want to check that out. You working on anything else?
Well, I also write regularly on National Review Online's bench memos, so I'd encourage people to look there. That's where, or for example, I've written about the Alabama Supreme Court ruling.
That sounds great. Hey, Ed, thank you. We will catch up again soon. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Drew.
That's Ed Whalen. It's bottom of the hour. I need to take a very short pause. When I come back, though, we'll change gears. Take a look at your license quickly. Do you have on your license the fact that you are an organ donor? I do. I'll give you full disclosure. I do. There are some Catholics who wonder whether or not we should do this. And I'm not against organ donation. As I said, I am an organ donor. However, some Catholic ethicists are a little worried about the new definitions that have come out regarding brain death and what it may mean for organ donors. Some of them may not be dead when their organs are harvested. I'll fill you in on this story when I return.
Your news. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Your news now.
The National Catholic Bioethics Center is sounding the alarm about a proposed redefinition of brain death put forward by the Uniform Law Commission. This new definition could cause Catholics to revoke their long support of organ donation. The proposed change includes language that would amend the legal definition of brain death from requiring whole brain death to just partial. This means living patients with severe brain damage could be declared legally dead and their vital organs harvested before they have actually passed from this life. This change puts patients at risk of exploitation and doctors in the ethically and medically dangerous position of choosing which patients are worth saving.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That's so creepy, isn't it? My thanks to EWTN News. Just told you about something that should give you pause. I'm always very hesitant when I deal with this issue because I personally am an organ donor, but when I want to do it ethically, you know, and I want to make sure that you and your loved ones are as well. So imagine someone not truly being dead, as you just heard, but still being given to the medical community for organ donation. Sounds like something out of a horror film. When you go to get your driver's license at the state's Department of Motor Vehicles, one of the questions you're always asked is whether or not you want to be an organ donor. I don't know whether you are or not. I know this has saved a lot of lives. For Catholics, you know, for me, I always thought it was a good idea. You know, I want to be generous in every way I can. What greater generosity than giving someone organs that could save their life, right? The Catechism of the Catholic Church, if you go to paragraph 2296, it says this. It says, donations of organs after death is a noble and meritorious act. It's to be encouraged as a manifestation of generous solidarity. So there you go, right? Teaching of the church, clear. I'll hold on for 1 second. Let me give you another perspective here too. There are some caveats. That same paragraph also says this, okay? It says, it is not morally acceptable if the donor of those who legitimately speak for him have not given their explicit consent. It's further morally inadmissible directly to bring about the disabling, mutilation, or death of a human being, even in order to delay the death of other persons. In other words, you got to be careful about making the decision to donate those organs. So what if I told you three Catholic moral philosophers believe that the majority of people who are donating their organs and are determined to be brain dead by their doctors aren't really dead? Disturbing, right? Those thinkers have put out a document and they're currently challenging the secular criteria for determining brain death. Brain death is supposed to be when brain activity is completely stopped. It's never going to function again. But the way doctors determine that has happened, it's being called into question right now by these three thinkers. And I'm joined right now by the president of the Tulsa Guide of Catholic Medical Association and a managing partner for Fidelis Radiology. Dr. Joseph Ebley joins me. He's one of the authors of this new document. And you can find this document. It's well worth checking out at catholicculture.org. And Maggie, maybe we can link over to it for everyone, make it easy for them. You can find it at our social media pages. You can go to our X platform or to Facebook. But again, I think it's well worth a read. Always gives me pause when I've got to address this. Doctor, it's good to have you with me. Good afternoon.
Thank you for having me with you. This is Joe Ebley, and I want to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. John DiCamillo and Dr. P. Colosi, yeah, and all 151 of the endorsers to that statement. So it's not simply three of us who are saying it, but 151 of us, and that includes healthcare professionals such as myself, theologians, philosophers, ethicists, lawyers, apologists, pro-life advocates, and a brain death survivor. So someone who was diagnosed as brain dead, but went on to become a nurse to try and help save people like herself. And so, Drew, what I was hoping to do,
sure,
was explain the statement for your listeners, okay, in a simple, straightforward manner,
okay,
and then talk about the three of the most important action steps. And so what I would like to tell your listeners is get a pen, get some paper, or if you're sitting at your computer, you can use your computer. But I may be one of the only people who has said, write these down because they're going to be important. I'm going to get to them sort of in a few minutes, but go ahead and prepare yourself because you want to write these down for yourself, for your loved ones, and to share with the people around you. And so what we did in this statement is we talked about something called brain death. Now, the idea behind brain death is that when the brain has ceased to function, then the person is dead. Now, that's a controversial subject, okay, among Catholics. Some believe that is true. Some do not believe that is true. At times, it has become quite divisive within the Catholic community. And so what we wanted to do, and the title of the statement is Catholics United on Organ Donation and Brain Death, is to bring Catholics together, regardless of whether they accept or reject the theoretical validity of brain death, to bring Catholics together to build unity on this issue. And so we said, what's the minimum bar that all Catholics accept must be present if a brain dead person is going to be truly dead? What is the minimum bar? What would everyone say must be present? And the answer is whole brain death, complete and irreversible cessation of all brain activity. The whole brain has to be dead. If that's not present, no Catholic would say that the patient is brain dead. All right? So, what happens in the real world when a doctor declares a patient brain dead? Do they test for whole brain death? The answer is no. Have they ever tested for whole brain death, ever? The answer is no. And I want your listeners to hear that. The answer is no. Whole brain death is not and never has been tested for by the medical community, ever. Over the past decade or so, it has become very clear from scientific studies that a part of the brain called the hypothalamus continues to function in the majority of patients declared brain dead. Now, the hypothalamus does a number of things, and depending on which function you evaluate, you come up with a different number. So, for example, if you look at water regulation, 50% of patients declared brain dead are alive. If you look at thyroid function, 84% of patients declared brain dead are alive because that part of the brain is continuing to function. Now, the reality is the reason that were focused on the statement and in the general medical community on hypothalamic function is because it's clinically obvious. In other words, it's very clear without doing any special testing that that part of the brain continues to function. But the reality is, in all likelihood, some part of the brain is functioning and essentially everyone declared brain dead. So, what does this mean? One, according to all Catholics, if brain death is possibly to be valid, which is disputed, I personally am convinced brain death does not represent the death of the human person and believe that it's very sound on both a metaphysical as well as a biological basis. But if brain death is possibly to be valid, whole brain death is required. Two, whole brain death is absent at least 50% of the time in patients declared brain dead. And I would say it's probably closer to 95 to 99% in all reality. When you actually look at the pathophysiology of brain death and the heterogeneity of what's going on in the brain, probably closer to nearly all of these patients still have brain function.
Well, that's so
the conclusion is, therefore, patients, and I'm going to repeat this, patients declared brain dead are alive either most of the time or all of the time at organ harvesting. Patients declared brain dead are alive most of the time or all of the time at organ harvesting. So the act of organ harvesting causes the patient's death.
Doctor, hold the thought. I've got to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. That is that's a real mic drop. It's a real bomb right there, and it's an eye-opener for a lot of people right now who are perhaps organ donors. I want to talk about the morality of what that portends and so much more. If you want to get in, I only have maybe 10, 15 minutes with Dr. Joseph Ebley, and you can dial in right now, 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149, taking a look at brain death, organ donation, and more. Stay with me.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Pray, hope, and don't worry. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. The Chaplet of Divine Mercy, coming up next.
Well, it is really good to be with you today. There is a very significant, I think, a thought-provoking development, a collective of about 151 Catholic doctors, ethicists, and theologians and other professionals have just come out with a document where they are voicing concerns regarding the adequacy of our current medical criteria for diagnosing brain death. And the document, they have a statement called Catholics United on Brain Death and Organ Donation, a call to action. Now, I'm a organ donor. This was released yesterday, and they're calling for really an immediate halt on the transplantation of vital organs from individuals declared brain dead under the current standards. And the group's, I guess, central critique is this, that medical standards that were revised in October of 2023 now diagnose brain death based on a partial rather than a complete irreversible cessation of brain function. And that statement suggests that under that current criteria, well, a majority of organ donors could still be alive at the times that their organs are harvested. Now, it's not just a group of guys who sit around and say, hey, let's do this. There are some major signatories on this. Some of the notables are Bishop Joseph Strickland, Anastasius Schneider, Oxford philosopher John Finnis, amongst others. And I'm joined by one of the authors of that document. Dr. Joseph Ebley joins me right now. And Doctor, this is huge. I don't know how much traction this is going to get or how serious people are going to take this and what organ donors should do. Let me let you just recap. I tried to put an exclamation point on the case you just made. Maybe you can restate and then ultimately give us some direction on what we can do.
Yeah. So just to recap, basically what we just said was that most, if not all, patients declared brain dead are alive at the time of organ harvesting. And I would like to thank all of our endorsers once again on this statement, because it takes tremendous courage to endorse this statement. There is an enormous amount of money involved in organ transplantation, and there is a lot of challenges in talking about this issue. And so it took tremendous courage for people like Bishop Strickland to sign on to this statement, and we are deeply grateful for them. Now, what I'm going to tell your listeners are three action steps that I want them to write down, and I want them to take to heart and share with others. All right, action steps that they can do to protect themselves and their loved ones. All right, one, when you get your driver's license at the DMV, choose not to be an organ donor.
Wow.
So when you get your driver's license at the DMV, choose not to be an organ donor.
Let me stop you on that point, doctor, because I'm an organ donor, right? I moved to a new state recently, signed up. What does somebody who already has it on their license do?
Well, and that's action point number two.
Perfect. There you go.
If you are already an organ donor on your driver's license, remove that status. All right. So if you are an organ donor, remove that status. Now, I need to explain that. It requires more than simply getting a new license that no longer has a little red heart on it. That takes it off of your license, but you are still registered as an organ donor. So you will have to actually get in touch with the organ donor registry of your state and get removed. And that can actually be quite challenging. It is very easy to become an organ donor. It is very difficult to cease being an organ donor. And that is another one of the action steps that we talk about, is that there is a discrepancy in terms of how difficult it is to get off that registry. But we, and when I say we, I mean 151 of us, we strongly recommend that you get off of the organ donor registry, because most likely, if you were an organ donor, you would be alive when your organs were harvested. Okay? You would be alive. And there are people who were declared brain dead who can remember very clearly the doctor talking about them,
yep,
who are alive today and with us. And we have no idea how many people are like that, because unresponsiveness, yep, is not unconsciousness.
Yep.
And I'm just want to get to this third point.
Sure.
Document refusal of organ donation after death in your advance directive. So document refusal of organ donation after death in your advance directive. Why? The reason is let's say you choose not to become an organ donor on your driver's license. You're not on the organ registry. But according to the 2009 Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, authorized persons can make you a donor even if you never registered after your death or as you are dying. So you need to have it documented in your medical record that you refuse to be an organ donor. So those are the three things that I want your listeners to remember from this presentation. Well, one, brain dead patients are mostly, if not all, alive. Don't be an organ donor on your driver's license. If you are, get it taken off. And be sure to have documented in your advance directive and medical records, right, that you do not want to donate your organs after death.
Let's do this, doctor. We only have a few minutes. We'll grab some calls. Yep. If you want to get in, feel free to join the conversation. You got a question or concern? You agree, you disagree, you want clarification? 888-914-9149. Bridget is in St. Paul, Minnesota. Bridget, hi. You're on the air with Dr. Epley.
Hi. Thank you. Great presentation. I want people to remember that when they have said they have made themselves a donor on their driver's license, that is a legal document. And as a physician, I know that we never just go ahead and do those donor, make someone a donor without family consent. But things could change. Mm-hmm. They do have the legal right to give your, even your minor child who is selected donor, they do have the legal right to make that child a donor. And we have to be very careful about that.
Well, thank you, Doctor. And Doctor, I believe I'll let you respond.
No, it's that's true. I mean, according to the 2009 Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, even if you are not registered, you can, an author, there's a list. So first of all, you have your healthcare power of attorney, then your spouse, then your adult children, and so on and so forth. But if there's no one else, then personnel at the hospital, an administrator, can make that decision for you.
So, doctor, before I go to, well, let me get Arlene in before time goes out. I got a follow up, just an ethical question for you. Arlene in Florida, good afternoon. Thanks for calling us.
Yes, good afternoon. I was calling you. I was very brokenhearted when my father was at Bayfront Hospital, and that is where he died. And he was a generous, kind, good Catholic man. He taught me many virtues. And what he was there. And he was an organ donor, and there was a young man that came in the room. I was on the other side. There was like an area where I was happened to be, and I wasn't in the same room exactly with my father, but I could walk around and go into him. Okay. But when I saw them going to take, when I saw the man with the red box, he had a red, like, attaché case kind of box, and he went up to my father, and he took out his corneas, and I went into the room, and I was very upset and so sad and overwhelmed.
And Arlene, just because I only have a moment or two left, was your father dead at this moment in time?
No, he was alert to me, and that's what broke my heart.
All right, Arlene, I'm so sorry to hear that. I can't imagine what you went through. Doctor, your thoughts, you can follow up on Arlene, and also just the ethics of this. We always want to do what's morally right. What's the criteria we should use when evaluating organ donation, or just not do it at all at this point?
I would suggest that you not do it at all in terms of dead donor donation. Obviously, it's okay to be a living donor. So if you have two kidneys, you give up one kidney, that's meritorious, as the catechism says. To give an organ is good, but you cannot take an organ in such a way that it kills a person.
Doctor, there's a call from Chicago. Carolina is on the line. She's a nurse. She was wondering if there are any cases that are an exception, like a gunshot wound to the head. So you've only have less than a minute, so I'll let you respond.
So if you have a gunshot wound to the head, there's much more going on than simply brain death, right? The person's exsanguinating. Yep. They're losing all their blood. They're hypotensive and hypovolemic. So there's much more going on, and that person is going to quickly, in all likelihood, die, and then their organs are not going to be good anymore, right? Because once you die, the organs begin decomposing. Right. So that's a traumatic gunshot wound is not the typical brain death donor case.
Doctor, let me hold it right there. I just want to get people plugged in. Go to Catholic Culture, to our social media. You can check out the document that Dr. Ebley, along with others, put together. I'll be right back.